looking right at each one of you. You are the initiate. You are the cosmic being.
Under the influence of LSD, Wan Tian had this vision that she's got to collect all these children from birth.
We've received the call. And great things will be done.
I'm wondering if you've got any comment to make now about what happened to the children.
Investigations are underway into a religious sect in Victoria known as the Family.
The sect was made up of professional people who worshipped Anne Hamilton Byrne as Jesus Christ reincarnated in the female form.
28 young people went through our hands.
Why did you do that?
I love children.
That's the trailer for Rosie Jones' documentary, The Family, about the Australian cult of the same name. It's a companion piece to the book, also called The Family, written by Rosie and investigative journalist Chris Johnston. Together, Rosie and Chris have created a breathtaking insight into the cult, its crimes, and its charismatic leader, Anne Hamilton Byrne.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Emily and I sat down with Chris Johnston recently to learn about how this group was able to infiltrate Australian institutions like hospitals and the Victorian Education Department, all for the sake of one woman's bizarre obsession with children and lust for money.
So she was born Evelyn Edwards. She was born in 1921 in Sale in Gippsland. At the time, Sale was literally a farming settlement with one street. Her mother was a POM, who was a paranoid schizophrenic who spent 30-odd years in asylums, as they were then called, in Victoria, and died in one, and was given that diagnosis upon her death. That's one of the sort of many things we found out about Anne's backstory while we were researching it.
How old was Anne when her mum died?
So she died in the late 50s, just as Anne was getting going, so late 30s.
Okay, so she'd spent her entire life, 30-year life, with a mum who had an undiagnosed, very serious mental illness.
Well, the thing is she hadn't spent much time with her at all because her mum was packed off to institutions.
Right.
And so
for such long periods of time that Anne was raised by someone else.
Yeah, in orphanages and sort of on her own with her siblings. Her father, meanwhile, was from sort of inner-city Melbourne and was also flaky. Went to both great wars, World War One and World War Two, which seemed to have changed him, and he sort of became kind of itinerant and left the family, as in his own family, not the family, which didn't exist yet.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, he basically legged it, and was found at one point when Anne was little in Port Fairy, which was a long way from where the family were living. Evelyn, as she was then, spent time in Brighton Orphanage and various other places. We found evidence of her going to a primary school in Sunshine when she was 8, so late 1920s.
Which is a western suburb of Melbourne.
Yeah.
So she's moved around a lot. I mean, it's one of those stories where if the story were to stop there, we would feel terribly sorry for this girl. This is a hell of a childhood.
She had an extremely dysfunctional childhood. Her mother, part of her mother's mental illness, we think, was the sort of delusions of spirituality. So her mother was someone who claimed to have her own Tibetan guru, who claimed to be able to speak to the dead. who held seances, was into mediums, and also is remembered as someone who set her hair on fire in public, in Sale.
Oh. Is there any suggestion of abuse in Anne's childhood, given that she was an orphan, moved around a lot?
No, okay. Except for, I guess, the kind of emotional abuse that comes with neglect and dysfunction.
Yeah. Wow. So she grew up to be a very beautiful young woman. When did you say that by the time her mum died, when Anne was in her 30s, she was already up and running? What do you mean by that?
Well,
what happens between orphanage and the family?
Well, she disappears off the radar for some time in around the 1940s. She got married quite young, and we found out that she, as early as sort of immediately post-war, so late 40s, her and her first husband were already planning to adopt a child or children from Barnardo's in Sydney. They lived in New South Wales at the time. That was curtailed when said husband died in a car accident in Bathurst.
So, again, that seems kind of, if I'd heard that story, I'd think, okay, here's a person who was orphaned and has compassion for other children without families and wants to help children in that way.
That's what she's always said,
mm.
that she wanted to help the children and that she loved the children. So sometime between the late 40s and the late 50s, that's when she reinvented herself. That's when she sort of transmogrified from Evelyn from Sale into an yoga teacher, spiritualist, and started to gather people towards her.
How do you do that? How did she do that?
Well, she did it through her yoga. So
we've all had great yoga teachers, but I mean, what makes you want to hand over your children to them or
was
whatever?
She in the hills at that stage, up in the Dandenongs?
She was just about there, yeah. So what happened was she seems to have become a yoga teacher in the sort of mid to late 50s in Melbourne. So that in itself is kind of remarkable because yoga was a very new phenomenon then. And she was, in fact, mentored by a woman called Marguerite Segersman, who was the, I guess, the sort of the person credited with, she was Swiss, with credited with bringing yoga to the West. And she was in Melbourne for a time as well. And Anne set up as a yoga teacher in Toorak and Geelong and also South Yarra, mainly in Toorak, in church halls, late 50s. So, you know, the Menzies kind of era, post-war sort of suburban Melbourne.
Pretty conservative.
Very, very conservative. And from all accounts, she was a very good yoga teacher back in those early days. But sometime in the late 50s, she began to sort of manipulate who was coming to the classes and the kind of treatment she gave them. So she started targeting wealthy Jewish women at first. They were sort of the 60s was sort of dawning. People were looking for new ideas and new things and different kind of religions and different ways of life. And she started very slowly to exert control over a small group of women.
But wealthy women.
Wealthy women. She targeted wealthy women specifically. And she started to get in their heads and started to offer them more than yoga. She started to offer them this kind of blend of sort of spiritual beliefs, which continued for the next 30 years in the cult that she formed. In around 1962, a very important thing happened, which was by then she had this group of people around her, and she'd figured out how to sort of infiltrate Melbourne society, so the upper echelons of society, and she'd begun to kind of attract enablers, people who could do things for her. And she targeted this guy called Dr. Rayner Johnson, who was the headmaster or master of Queen's College at Melbourne University. And he was a professor of physics, and he was from Leeds, and he'd been headhunted by Melbourne Uni in the 1930s as a sort of a marquee signing for the uni to come out and head up Queen's.
Sounds like a pretty marquee signing for Anne as well.
Yeah, so he was a very eminent physicist, but by the time he got to Melbourne, it was kind of going to be his last job.
Okay.
But he was here for quite some time, and eventually Anne found him. We think through his books, because by then he'd moved from pure physics into metaphysics, so he'd stopped writing about atoms and stuff and had started writing about spiritualism, karma, religion, alternative religions, and he'd also started writing about this idea of a guru, of a master who can lead you through life, which, you know, was a sort of, for him, probably a blend of sort of Buddhism and Tibetan beliefs. And he'd also come through that period in the UK where they were into seances and Ouija boards and all that. Anyway, so she came across him and literally turned up at his house on the grounds of Queen's one day in 1962, just after Christmas, and literally knocked on his door. We got his diary, so we know this to be true. By then she'd got a bit of intel on him from a man who she was having a kind of on-off relationship with, who was working on the grounds of the university, first as a gardener and then in catering. And this man had told her all about Rayner and about his sort of daily movements and his plans for the future. And she bamboozled him with her knowledge of his life, and he believed that she could see the future.
Oh, no.
And that fitted his growing beliefs about gurus and alternative religions and spiritualism. And a couple of months later, literally, he was taking LSD in the Dandenongs at her house and writing in his diary that he thought that she was Jesus, as she was beginning to say by then.
Wow.
So that that gave her growing group a veneer of respectability, because he was an eminent man. He was respected in Melbourne. He was hanging out with the people who were involved in setting up the modern Liberal Party. He was going to the private clubs. He was friends with a fellow called Ambrose Pratt, who was a very influential writer and editor in Melbourne at the time. So she sort of finangled her way into this very influential group of men, really. And he was able to do two things. One was to bring people to her, and the other was to give her group, which by then was fully into LSD, not quite child stealing yet, that was yet to come, it gave it that respectability, and people thought that it was fine because Rayner was involved.
When was there a sense that there was a bigger plan coming together for Anne? When did she start sort of buying the property? When did the group get a name? When was all of that happening?
Well, very early 60s, when Rayner was lured in, when she'd sort of transformed from a yoga teacher into a spiritual leader.
She starts saying she's Jesus. She starts agreeing with her.
Yeah, she starts getting hold of the LSD, which is a whole nother story. They set up a little chapel in a sort of shed, really, on Rayner's property at Ferntree Gully. And shortly after, they start building a sort of a church over the road, which is still there.
Wow.
And he, meanwhile, is doing kind of lecture tours and whatnot and speaking at things like CAE, Council of Adult Education, at schools and stuff. And a lot of people are going to that, and he's bringing people to her.
Wow, and it's getting like a real air of authority, I guess. And is this when the money starts being made? When she's building property by this stage.
Yeah, so she's by this time she's also people are giving her money, and she's also starting to essentially steal money or defraud money or falsify documents through a lawyer who she had lured into the cult as well with his then wife, a guy called Peter Kibbe.
What sort of money? Where's she stealing money from?
Just through dodgy real estate deals, through this lawyer who was falsifying documents for her. We think that's what happened anyway. Oh. Donations. Don't forget there are a lot of wealthy people around the group at this time. Mm. There's you know, lawyers. There's you know, she really loved white collar people. It's that thing of attracting enablers. So sort of by the early to mid 60s, she had her own lawyer in the cult. She had her own real estate agent. She had an architect, and she had a bunch of psychologists and psychiatrists who were able to secure the LSD, which at that time was legal for therapy in Victoria if you had a license. Now, she also, by this time, had control of a psychiatric hospital in Kew, a place called New Haven, which is still there, but it's a private home now. It's actually just been sold for $10 million. It's a beautiful Victorian mansion. But back then it was a hospital, private psychiatric hospital. And she had three psychiatrists working there. She was floating around there. She was recruiting people from there. So people...
How did that happen? How did she get the authority to be floating around a...
Sounds so loose back then.
Oh my God,
it?
That's unbelievable. So I guess were the doctors followers of hers or?
Yeah, pretty much everyone that worked there were followers of hers, and the place was owned by a cult member as well.
Wow.
And she was quite at this stage, she'd physically transformed a bit, hadn't she? Had she started to get the plastic surgery? She was quite a striking woman. What was that part of her ability to bewitch these men?
Yeah, so she bewitched men and women with her beauty. I mean, there's no doubt she was incredibly glamorous. Mm. She was an early adopter of the plastic surgery thing. She used to go to a place in Kew near New Haven called the Cotham Clinic for facelifts.
That was quite a scene at New Haven, wasn't it? They were giving patients LSD.
Yeah, so
people with mental illness, they were giving them LSD and encouraging them through their trips. I'm reading in the book, encouraging them to think about certain things, and in that way, it became a recruitment ground as well.
Yeah, so LSD was legal for therapy. So if you had a license, you had to get a license through the Victorian state government.
Can I ask you a personal question?
Yeah.
Have you ever taken LSD?
Yeah.
Same. Now I
feel left out.
I used to take a lot of acid in my late teens, and when Lex DeMann says, he's the investigating officer, says in your book, you know, everyone would be dosed up on the drug. She'd wear a billowing white dress, shine a few lights around, and bingo. People would think she was Jesus. I can relate to that. I can understand how that could work. Like, it's a pretty powerful setup she's got going here, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, it's really important to know that the how the LSD was being given to these people. So at the time, there were 19 psychiatrists in Melbourne who had these state government licenses to use it for therapy.
Oh, wow.
And three of them were cult, and they all worked at New Haven. And, in fact, the guy who headed the state government committee to approve or disprove the licenses was cult.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's an incredibly powerful nexus.
So the stuff was coming in liquid form from Switzerland, from the same laboratory where Albert Hofmann first discovered it in 1949. They were getting it straight from there. Ooh. It was coming into Sydney in little ampoules. And then,
so it was good gear.
It was extremely good gear. There was also synthesised mushies, so psilocybin. Ooh. They were using a lot of that as well. So not only by now did she have lawyers, real estate agents and architects, but she had compliant psychiatrists who could fiddle the system and get LSD for her. It was all coming into New Haven, but it was being funneled up to the Dandenongs to homes, specifically one home of one of the psychiatrists, which of course was, you know, a massive breach of the regulations that they were supposed to adhere to.
I would think that giving it to children was a pretty big breach as well, but they were doing that.
Well, they were giving children sedatives to keep them quiet, but when they turned 14, they started giving them LSD, yeah, teenagers. So that's when the whole kids thing started coming in. So we think it was probably about 1969, 70, 71, when she first started fiddling the adoption set up in hospitals in Melbourne to steal children from women, from single women who at that time were, you know, you got to remember that single mums and pregnancy and, you know, family shame was a completely different sort of setup then. So there were hundreds and thousands of unmarried women giving birth in hospitals like the Royal Women's and Box Hill and others.
We'll hear about the process by which Anne ended up with other people's babies after the break. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Chris tells us about the time he visited Anne Hamilton Byrne in her suburban aged care facility. But first, we hear about the terrifying influence she once had in Melbourne hospitals.
So what was the process by which Anne got involved in that? So let's say, for example, one of the babies who went through this process was Sarah, and Sarah Moore, and we'll come back to Sarah. She's significant to the story for a lot of reasons. So she was born in 1969. Her biological mother was an unmarried teenager. This happened in Melbourne. So how does Anne infiltrate the system and get access to this baby?
Because she had enablers within the hospital system and the social work system.
Wow.
So she had doctors, nurses and social workers in those hospitals who would tell her when someone was coming in and where there might be an opportunity. Specifically, she had two social workers who were working in the adoption scene who were able to tell her exactly when and where these opportunities might arise. And
so
it was literally
teenagers come in about to have a baby, get on the phone, tell Anne.
It was literally a case of, and this is hard to believe, but a baby such as Sarah would be delivered by a cult doctor, attended by a cult nurse, and taken or sort of documented or whatever by a cult social worker. So there were cases of kids literally handed to these people in hospitals and then literally walked down a corridor and handed to one of Anne's henchwomen in the hospital who had come to take the baby away.
It's like something from a movie. Like, you can't believe it's happening in Melbourne. Yeah.
And again, terrifying. As often happens on this show, it's hard to believe it's not a very well-known story. The facts of the matter that our medical system was infiltrated by a person like Anne Hamilton Byrne so recently.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, at first the kids went up to various homes in the Dandenongs, and by then she had a sort of little enclave in Ferny Creek, centred around one particular street in Ferny Creek where she lived. And she had cult families living up there. So the women and their husbands who were sort of lured into it bought property up there at her behest because she wanted her people to live around her. They had this little meeting place at Rayner's, and they had this chapel over the road which called the Santa Canetan Lodge, which they'd built, where they met twice a week. So they had a strong presence up there, and the kids were up there to begin with. But then sometime in the early 70s, they got this property at Lake Eildon, sort of 2 hours away, basically a sort of a fibro lake house, and that that became the centre of operations for raising the children as cult members.
Is that Kai Lama?
Yeah.
That's Kai Lama. So it's lots of space and isolated. It's the sort of a place where people maybe had holiday houses, things of that nature.
It was a holiday house, yeah.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of prying eyes around
there. No, it was beside the lake, though, and it was behind trees, but it was quite remote, dirt roads and stuff. So by sort of 73, 74, the kids were split into two groups. One were the so-called Hamilton Burn kids, who were all up at Lake Eildon, 14 of them. So by the mid-70s, there were sort of 14 of them there, and they were the ones that got their hair dyed blonde, and they were given fake names with the Hamilton Burn surname. And then there were another 14 who were called Fosters, and they lived at various houses in the Dandenongs, and they used their own names or other names but not Hamilton Burn, and they didn't get their hair dyed, and they were usually the children of cult adults.
After the break, we delve into the complicated world of the aunties, the women left in charge of the cult children. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Chris tells us about his visit with Anne Hamilton Burn. But first, the day-to-day lives of the cult children were exposed when two of them escaped and sought help. Chris tells us more.
Were they all sort of watched over by the aunties? These were the women who worked for Anne. And they were very present at Kai Lama.
Yep. So the aunties were a group of sort of three or four or five rusted on cult women who mainly hung out at the Lake Eildon house, but also had a presence in the hills.
Mm.
And they were the sort of disciplinarians. They were, whatever they did before, they were made to become nurses. So they were doing 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off at hospitals. So 2 weeks working down in Melbourne somewhere, then they would bring their money back and come back to Lake Eildon and look after the kids.
Ingenious.
However, they did not really look after them very well.
No. Mm. What sort of discipline was used on the kids?
Severe physical abuse. So, look, it's really important, I think, to, and one conclusion that we came to during the sort of making of all this and the research was that the aunties or the disciplinarians were victims as well. So they were women who were lured in by Anne and became trapped. I mean, they were women who were economically trapped and emotionally trapped and physically trapped and sort of spiritually trapped as well. So even though they beat the children and hurt the children and starved the children and drugged the children, I think they were also victims of Anne, and that victimhood sort of led to them punishing them in this way. I mean, they were the girls in particular were starved around body shape and weight. They were all hit with canes. There was a three-cornered cane that they were hit with a lot. They were hit with shoes and heels. They were dunked in buckets of water till they nearly drowned. They were sort of locked away. And, of course, they weren't interacting with the outside world at all during this time. The cult set up a school at the lake house.
This is one of the most incredible details to me, along with the infiltration of the medical system. Mm. The Victorian Education Department came out and checked out the school set up, didn't they?
Correct. So there was a cult guy who's still alive called Leon Dawes, who was a teacher at Croydon High, and he was cult and still is, and so is his son. His son's very important to the whole setup now, Geoffrey Dawes. Leon was a sort of an uncle at the lake house, and he became their teacher with his wife, who was also a teacher in real life. He was taking books from Croydon High up to the school. It was kind of an unofficial school, but then they decided to set up and register a school. So, yeah, you're right. At that point, they had to be supposedly be monitored and registered and all that with the Victorian government. And as part of this, we got hold of some files by the actual school's inspector who came to visit the school. And he was full of glowing reports. He said that the kids were intelligent, which they were. Sarah Moore, in fact, said that, who went on to become a doctor, said that the actual schooling, the book schooling, was really good. However, the kids there all had the same surname and were dressed outlandishly in Anne's choice of clothing for them, which was velour or gingham, a sort of baroque, sort of weird clothing. They had dyed hair. They acted strangely, but they sort of put on this veneer of sort of happiness when the inspector came. And his reports back to the government found nothing wrong.
He didn't think any of that was weird or worth checking in on again.
No, he didn't. He thought it was marvellous.
Oh.
Unbelievable.
And Sarah, I always remember Sarah from, I think, was it in the 1990 60 Minutes, did some stuff, or Anne and Sarah were in the media a bit, and I remember as a teenager knowing, oh, yes, Sarah, a doctor, all this was happening in the hills, but then it did go kind of quiet until, you know, your investigations and a bit more interest in it.
Well, I suppose the point was, I mean, Sarah, she was called, well, Sarah Moore was her real name, and she, along with another cult girl called, whose real name is Leanne but was called Anna in the cult, they eventually led to the cult's sort of undoing, because Leanne escaped and Sarah was thrown out, and on the outside world, as sort of 17-year-old girls, they cooked up a plan to talk to the police.
How bizarre was the outside world for these girls at 17?
Well, very. But probably not as bizarre as the inside.
You think?
The inside,
you think they realised?
But they've all struggled. I mean, Sarah's no longer with us. She died just as the book was being published.
Well, Sarah had...
She was only, you know, aged in her 40s.
She had drug issues throughout her life, would that be fair to say?
When she left the cult, she's very bright, very intelligent. She got into Melbourne Uni Medicine, became a doctor, went and worked in the Third World as a doctor in refugee camps. Then came back to Melbourne and set up, but her past sort of came back to haunt her, really. She was incredibly badly treated by the cult when she was in it, because she was sort of the oldest girl, and she was Anne's favourite, which meant that she got the harshest treatment.
And she rebelled, didn't she? She got a bit argumentative as a teenage girl, as we do.
Yeah, but her memories of the LSD that she was administered are just horrific.
Oh yeah.
This is over in England. I mean, we're talking monumental doses of very strong LSD for weeks at a time. Wow. Like, not just single doses, weeks at a time, and like brainwashing and all that. And she, when she was doctoring here in Melbourne, she started prescribing pethidine to herself and ran into issues with that, and her mental health was very poor, and she tried to commit suicide and messed it up and lost a leg as a result of an injection that she gave herself, and was then confined to a wheelchair, and then it sort of went downhill for her after that, and she ended up dying of some kind of heart condition a couple of years ago. But she's a heroic figure in this story. And so is Leanne, who also kind of rung the bell on the cult. Leanne physically escaped from the lake house.
I find it extraordinary that they had the courage at 17 to go to the police already. They were just out and the world must have been terrifying. But they went and they rang the bell.
Eventually they did. It wasn't quite as simple as that because they were traumatised. Mm. Don't forget, also in 1987, the police finally raided the house. This was after, just after Sarah and Leanne had spoken to them. The coppers had been up there before several times but had found nothing wrong. The federal police had been up to look for a girl that was missing, did nothing. It was on Victoria Police radar for ages, did nothing.
The local police would have been aware up in the hills of, you know, I
guess. The local police were aware of it. Yeah. In fact, a local policeman in at Lake Eildon helped Leanne when she escaped.
Oh, wow.
Still nothing happened. Then, you know, a year later or something, they raided the house and freed the children. But Anne was long gone. By then she was a multimillionaire and she had homes all over the world, and she was in the Catskills near New York in her mansion there.
So what did they find when they freed the children? Were there criminal charges criminal charges pressed around that time? Did they find any criminal activity going on there?
No, not at the time. There's a long and complex sort of backstory with police action around the cult. Some of the aunties were charged for document fraud. There were no drugs up there. Mm. And the feeling was that because the children that were freed were so traumatised, they were a bit younger than Sarah and Leanne. The oldest would have been 15, so they would have been, you know, between 12 and 15. One of them was basically skeletal, a young girl. One of them was had issues around a brain injury, around some treatment that he got up there by one of the cult men. The feeling was that the kids needed to be looked after rather than sort of cross-examined on what had happened to them.
Okay.
So they were put in state care and then sort of slowly sort of adopted out or helped to find their own families or helped to sort of settle into their lives, and thus began the police chase. So after years and years of inaction by state and federal police, Vicpol finally gave the other hero of this story, Lex Demann, the imprimatur to set up a squad, Operation Forest, dedicated to dismantling the cult and laying charges on the guilty parties.
And he was very dedicated. I was lucky enough to see him speak after a screening of the documentary, and he broke down in tears as he spoke, certainly as he spoke about Sarah. So let's talk about his investigation. I mean, how does one attempt, when this woman's got a 30-year head start by this stage, and she's a multimillionaire and she's living overseas, where do we start?
Well, he started with Peter Kibbe, the lawyer who I mentioned before.
Right.
Peter Kibbe had left the cult by then because he'd grown sick of the manipulation. Just to fill you in, Peter Kibbe had OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. He was a man who showered for hours and hours, and that's how he got into the cult in the first place, because he was getting psychiatric treatment for his troubles. He was still a functioning solicitor in Melbourne, but he was mentally ill. And he was the one that enabled, through the sort of glory days of the cult, gathering the children, gathering the properties and the money, he was the one who was either falsifying the documents or having them falsified, right? So then he leaves because he's just jack of it after 20, 30 years of manipulation and guilt and doing the wrong thing. He left. So Lex and his police mates thought, he's the key that can unlock the door.
Yeah.
Let's find something he's done wrong that we can prove. which they did. They found a document that he'd falsified, and they proved it to be falsified, and they went and arrested him. He was living in a country town by then as a country lawyer. They arrested him and convinced him to tell all, which he did over 3 months of daily interviews at St Kilda Road in, what, late 80s, early 90s?
Wow, that long ago.
And he provided them with basically everything they needed to know. So it's important because the cult leader said she was Jesus and she controlled everybody in the cult, controlled everything to do with their lives, and one thing that she expressly disallowed was betrayal. In fact, the cult had a mantra that she made up, which is sort of like a biblical-sounding paragraph that they all had to recite at their little meetings that was all about betrayal. Don't tell anyone about me. Don't talk about what you know. Don't share the knowledge that I've given you. Don't betray me, right? Mm. Peter Kibbe spectacularly betrays her to the police, which was quickly followed by one of the aunties, Trish McFarlane, who had also left and nicked off to the UK. They tracked her down and she did the same. And then they had allegations of physical abuse, emotional abuse, drug administration, kidnapping, false imprisonment, document fraud, blah, blah, blah. But they couldn't find her, so they had to go find her. And that's when the international sort of manhunt or woman hunt began.
And were international authorities helpful?
Yep, so they had Interpol in the UK, Scotland Yard, and the FBI in the United States, because they knew that she had a bunch of properties in the UK and Hawaii and mainland United States. Mm. So they got all those agencies in because they had to extradite her, they had to find her, then they had to try and bring her back, which they did.
So it was 1994 when Lex Deman and his task force finally managed to bring Anne and Bill back to Australia, to extradite them back to Australia.
Yeah.
And it was quite a, as is always the case in these situations, so much going on, but it's a very specific case that they finally managed to bring them back on, isn't it?
Yeah, it's bittersweet. So they only got her on minor charges. I mean, the headline is they were able to extradite her, but because of vagaries between US law and Victorian law, and because of this notion that they didn't want the kids cross-examined on, even though it was, you know, 10 years later or whatever, they didn't want them cross-examined on physical, emotional abuse. They could only bring them back on very minor charges.
So it was conspiracy to defraud and commit perjury by falsely registering the births of triplets.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's what they got them on.
Yeah, so that was the only way they could extradite them. And Lex, if you ask Lex now, so did it succeed or fail? He would say that it succeeded because he found her, got her arrested, got her on a Qantas back to Melbourne, got her into the county court where she pleaded guilty. Now, for him, hearing her say guilty, even though it was a charge that wasn't going to bring her a jail term and, in fact, only got her a $5,000 fine, I mean, some might argue that that was a complete failure of the justice system, but he, given the context and the circumstances, he thinks that it was probably on balance successful.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the undoing of the cult. They started to I mean, she talked big after that. She said she wanted to go around again and get more kids and have another crack, but she never did.
She was quite elderly by that stage too, wasn't it?
Lost her looks.
Yeah, she was ageless forever.
Weird facelift,
She was ageless forever, and then all of a sudden she was a very elderly lady.
She'd lost her looks and her power. Great story about her arrest, though. So they had the FBI on board, and there was an FBI agent called Hilda Kogut. She's in the book. And she was heading the little FBI operation. Once they'd found out that Anne was in residence at the house in the Catskills, and they found that out because Anne made a phone call back to Melbourne to Sarah, and Sarah dobbed her in. They started staking out the house, and Hilda disguised herself in a mail van. She got in the because it's a rural area where the house was, and she got in the mail van with the rural mail delivery person, not dressed as a policewoman, obviously, and went and looked at the house and put mail in the mailbox and then waited to see who would come out. And then a couple of days later, they raided the house when they knew for sure that Anne and Bill were there early in the morning. And Anne was startled, didn't have a wig on, wasn't dressed properly, was demanding all this time to get dressed, and they just hustled her off to this sort of jail at a place called White Plains near New York. The straw that broke the camel's back was someone in jail was murdered next to the cell where Bill was being held, and he freaked out and at that point said, "I'm out of here, let's go home, let's just cop it sweet." And she agreed. And by then they'd sort of negotiated the charges down to these minor charges. Anne had a QC, a very eminent Melbourne QC. If they tried to lay charges around the drugs or the abuse, they would plead not guilty. The kids who were now young adults would have to be cross-examined by this silk, and they decided not to do that, which was a sort of kind of humanitarian decision rather than anything. But they got her back. But she walked out of court, paid her fine, and scuttled off back to the hills.
How many members are there now?
Well, they don't do anything anymore. They're not recruiting. There haven't been any new members for years and years.
Okay.
Their church is falling into disrepair. They still own it and the land, however. The people who still follow her are either extremely old, i.e. in their 90s, or around 50. There's only a handful of them. They claim that they still meet at the lodge, but we don't think they do, and their neighbours don't think they do either. And certainly from going in there and having a look at it, it didn't look like it had been used for a long time.
Is there a lot of money still?
Yeah.
How much do you reckon? Do you have an estimate?
We sort of said, we were saying between 5 and 10 mil.
Okay.
And recent inquiries have confirmed that.
In yet another bizarre twist, a current cult member offered to take Chris to see Anne in her suburban aged care facility. This is how it went.
He literally just took us to the nursing home where she lives and introduced us as friends of his. It was this little old lady sitting in a chair. Because she had so many facelifts for so long, her hairline is at the top of her head. So her hairline is sort of almost going backwards on her head now. She was beautifully dressed. She had pearls on, immaculately dressed, beautiful little slip-on shoes. I'll never forget the little slip-on shoes. Tons and tons of jewellery on her fingers and round her neck. And in her ears, but just sort of like in a vegetative state.
Who dresses her? Is there someone from the cult who goes and does that, who cares for her?
I don't know if the cult member dresses her, but I know that a cult member goes in and gets her dirty washing and takes it home and washes it and brings it back all folded.
Okay.
And I guess we were there for an hour or two, and she was drinking one of those milk protein drinks through a straw on a little tray. And she had a plastic doll, which for some of the time she was cradling, which was incredibly disturbing.
I believe that's quite common for female dementia patients to be given a baby doll.
It is, but this is a woman who stole babies.
Yes. Yes, I understand. I understand.
Incredibly disturbing.
Yes.
Also disturbing was the fact that evidence of her life as a cult leader was all around her in the room. So photographs of the children, photographs of her husbands, particularly Bill, lots of photographs of herself. And then beside her bed, I saw something which gave me the prologue for my book, which was a print of The Last Supper. So here was a woman who positioned herself as Jesus and forbade betrayal, but in the end was spectacularly betrayed by those closest to her, just like Jesus.
Chris Johnston and Rosie Jones' book The Family is available now, and the excellent documentary is also available on iTunes. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. Please take a moment to give us a nice review, and please encourage your friends to give us a listen.